Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents the Night Angel Trilogy, Shadow's Edge Part 1. Created by Brent Weeks. Narrated by Dylan Lynch. With performances by Eric Messner, Laura Quinn Anderson, Ren Casey, Ken Jackson, Christopher Graybill, Michael Glenn, Terrence Azelford, Tim Getman, M.B. Van Dorn, Elizabeth Jernigan, Rick Rowan, Colleen Delaney, Johan Detweiler, Tony Penny, Joe Brack, Casey Platt, Nanette Savard, Lily Beacon, Mort Shelby, James Lewis, Scott McCormick, and Yasmin Troison. Shadow's Edge, Part 1.
We've got a contract for you.
As always, Mama Kay sat like a queen, her back straight, sumptuous dress perfect, hair immaculately coiffed, if gray at the roots. This morning, she had dark circles under her eyes. Kyler guessed that none of the Sakage's surviving leaders had slept much since the Kalidoran invasion.
Good morning to you, too.
Kyler settled into the wing-backed chair in the study. Mama Kay didn't turn to face him, looking instead out her window. Last night's rain had quenched most of the fires in the city, but many still smoked, bathing the city in a crimson dawn. The waters of the Plith River that divided rich eastern Sonaria from the Warrens looked red as blood. Kyler wasn't sure that was all because of the smoke-obscured sun, either. In the weeks since the coup, the Kalidoran invaders had massacred thousands.
There's a wrinkle. The debtor knows it's coming.
How's he know?
We told him.
Kyler rubbed his temples. The Sakage would only tell someone so that if the attempt failed, the Sakage wouldn't be committed. That meant the debtor could only be one man. Sonaria's conqueror, Kalidor's god-king, Geroth Ur-Sul.
I just came to get my money. All of Durza's, my safe house is burned down. I only need enough to bribe the gate guards.
Kyler had been giving her a cut of his wages to invest since he was a child. She should have plenty for a few bribes. Mama Kay flipped through sheets of rice paper on her desk and handed one to Kyler. At first, he was stunned by the numbers. He was involved in the illegal importation of riot weed and half a dozen other addictive plants, owned a racehorse, had a stake in a brewery, and several other businesses, part of a loan shark's portfolio, and owned partial cargoes of items like silks and gems that were legitimate, except for the fact the Sakage paid 20% in bribes rather than 50% in tariffs. The sheer amount of information on the page was mind-boggling. He didn't know what half of it meant.
I own a house?
Owned. This column denotes merchandise lost in the fires or looting.
There were checks next to all but a silk expedition and one for riot weed. Almost everything he had owned was lost.
Neither expedition will return for months, if at all. If the God King keeps seizing civilian vessels, they won't come back at all. Of course, if he were dead...
This says my share is still worth 10 to 15,000. I'll sell it to you for 1,000. That's all I need.
They need a third wet boy to make sure it works. 50,000 gunders for one kill, Kyler. With that much, you can take Eileen annually anywhere. You'll have done the world a good turn, and you'll never have to work again. It's just one last job.
There's always one last job. I'm finished.
This is because of Eileen, isn't it?
Mama Kay, do you think a man can change?
No. And he'll end up hating anyone who asks him to.
Kyler got up and walked out the door. In the hallway, he ran into Jarl. Jarl was grinning like he used to when they were growing up on the streets and he was up to no good. Jarl was wearing what must be the new fashion, a long tunic with exaggerated shoulders paired with slim trousers tucked into high boots. It looked vaguely Kalidoran. His hair was worked into elaborate micro-braids capped with gold beads that set off his black skin.
I've got the perfect job for you.
No killing?
Not Exactly. Your Holiness, the cowards stand ready to redeem themselves.
Lord Meister Nefdada was an old man, veiny, liver-spotted, stooped, stinking of death held at bay with magic. 12 knotted cords hung over the shoulders of his black robes for the 12 shuras he'd mastered. Nef knelt with difficulty and offered a handful of straw to the God King. God King Garoth Ur-Sul stood on the platform inspecting his troops. Front and center were nearly 200 Gravar Highlanders, tall, barrel-chested, blue-eyed savages who wore their black hair short and their mustaches long. On either side stood the other elite Highland tribes that had captured the castle. Beyond them waited the rest of the regular army that had marched into Sonaria since the liberation. Mists rose from the Plith River on either side of the castle and slid under the rusty teeth of the iron portcullises to chill the crowd. The Gravar had been broken into 15 groups of 13 each, and they alone had no weapons, armor, or tunics. They stood in their trousers, pale faces fixed, but sweating instead of shivering in the cool autumn morning. There was never commotion when the God King inspected his troops, but today the silence ached despite the thousands gathered to watch. Garoth had gathered every soldier possible and allowed the Sonarian servants and nobles and small folk to watch as well. Meisters in their black and half-red cloaks stood shoulder to shoulder with robed verdmeisters, soldiers, crofters, coopers, nobles, field hands, maids, sailors, and Sonarian spies. The God King wore a broad white cloak edged with ermine thrown back to make his broad shoulders look huge. Beneath that was a sleeveless white tunic over wide white trousers. All the white made his pallid Caladoran skin look ghostly and drew sharp attention to the veer playing across his skin. Black tendrils of power rose to the surface of his arms. Great knots rose and fell, knots edged with thorns that moved not just back and forth, but up and down in waves, pressing out from his skin. Claws raked his skin from beneath. Nor were his veer confined to his arms. They rose to frame his face. They rose to his bald scalp and pierced the skin, forming a thorny, quivering black crown. Blood trickled down the sides of his face. For many Sonarians, it was their first glimpse of the God King. Their jaws hung slack. They shivered as his gaze passed over them. It was exactly as he intended. Finally, Garoth selected one of the pieces of straw from Nefdada and broke it in half. He threw away one half and took 12 full-length pieces.
Thus shall Kali speak.
He signaled the Gravar to climb the platform. During the liberation, they had been ordered to hold this yard to contain the Sonarian nobles for slaughter. Instead, the Highlanders had been routed, and Tara Grayson and her nobles had escaped. That was unacceptable, inexplicable, uncharacteristic for the fierce Gravar. Garoth didn't understand what made men fight one day and flee the next. What he did understand was shame. For the past week, the Gravar had been mucking stables, emptying chamber pots, and scrubbing floors. They had not been allowed to sleep, instead spending the nights polishing their betters' armor and weapons. Today, they would expiate their guilt, and for the next year, they would be eager to prove their heroism. As he approached the first group, with Nef at his side, Garoth calmed the veer from his hands. When the men drew their straws, they must think it not the working of magic or the God King's pleasure that spared one and condemned another. Rather, it was simple fate, the inexorable consequence of their own cowardice. Garoth held up his hands.
Kalivas, Kalivos wrath at me. Kali me virtu rapt, Reku virtum defite.
As the words faded, the first soldier approached. He was barely 16, the least fringe of a mustache on his lip. He looked on the verge of collapse as his eyes flitted from the God King's icy face to the straws. His naked chest shone with sweat in the rising morning light, his muscles twitching. He drew a straw. It was long. Half of the tension whooshed out of his body, but only half. The young man next to him, who looked so alike he must have been his older brother, licked his lips and grabbed a straw. It was short. Queasy relief washed over the rest of the crowd, and the thousands watching who couldn't possibly see the short straw knew that it had been drawn from their reactions. The man who'd drawn the short straw looked at his little brother. The younger man looked away. The condemned man turned disbelieving eyes on the God King and handed him the short straw.
Kali has spoken.
The God King nodded to the squad. They closed on the young man, every one of them, even his brother, and began beating him. It would have been faster if Gareth had left the squad wear gauntlets or used the butts of spears or the flat of blades, but he thought it was better this way. When the blood began flowing and spraying off flesh as it was pummeled, it shouldn't get on the squad's clothing. It should get on their skin. Let them feel the warmth of the young man's blood as he died. Let them know the cost of cowardice. Caladorans did not flee. In 2 minutes, the young man was dead. The squad reformed, blood spattered and blowing hard from exertion and emotion. They didn't look at the corpse at their feet. Gareth regarded each in turn, meeting the eyes of every one and lingering on the brother. Standing over the corpse, Gareth extended a hand. The beard poked out of his wrist and extended claw-like, ragged, and gripped the corpse's head. Then the claws convulsed, and the head popped in a spray of blood and gore.
Your sacrifice is accepted. Thus you are cleansed.
The God King saluted them, and they returned his salute proudly and took their places back in the formation in the courtyard as the body was dragged away. He motioned the next squad. The next 14 iterations would be nothing but more of the same. Though tension still arced through every squad, even the squads who'd finished would lose friends and family in other squads, Gareth lost interest.
Neff, tell me what you learned about this man, this Night Angel who killed my son.
Sonaria Castle wasn't high on Kyla's list of places to visit. He was disguised as a tanner, a temporary dye staining his hands and arms to the elbow, a spattered woolen tradesman's tunic, and a number of drops of a special perfume his dead master Durzo Blint had developed. He reeked only slightly less than a real tanner would. Durzo had always preferred disguises of tanners, pig farmers, beggars, and other types that respectable people did their best not to see because they couldn't help but smell them. The perfume was applied only to the outer garments, so if need arose, they could be shed. Some of the stench would still cling, but every disguise had drawbacks. The art was matching the drawbacks to the job. East King's Bridge had burned during the coup, and though the Meisters had repaired most of its length, it was still closed, so Kyla crossed West King's Bridge. The Caladoran guards barely glanced at him as he passed them. It seemed everyone's attention, even the Meisters, was riveted to a platform in the center of the castle yard and a group of Highlanders standing bare-chested in the cold. Kyla ignored the squad on the platform as he scanned for threats. He still wasn't sure if Meisters could see his talent, though he suspected they couldn't as long as he wasn't using it. Their abilities seemed much more tied to smell than Magi's, which was the reason he'd come as a tanner. If a Meister came close, Kyla could only hope that mundane smells interfered with magical ones. 4 guards stood on each side of the gate, 6 on each segment of the diamond-shaped castle wall, and perhaps 1,000 in formation in the yard, in addition to the 200 or so Graavar Highlanders. In the crowd of several thousand, 50 Meisters were placed at regular intervals. In the center of it all, on the temporary platform, were a number of Cenarian nobles, mutilated corpses, and God King Gareth Ursul himself speaking with a Wurdmeister. It was ridiculous, but even with the number of soldiers and Meisters here, this was probably the best chance a wet boy would have to kill the man. But Kyler wasn't here to kill. He was here to study a man for the strangest job he'd ever accepted. He scanned the crowd for the man Jarl had told him about and found him quickly. Baron Kirov had been a vassal of the Gyres. With his lord dead and his lands close to the city, he'd been one of the first Cenarian nobles to bend the knee to Gareth Ursul. He was a fat man with a red beard cut in the angular lowland Caladoran style, a large crooked nose, weak chin, and great bushy eyebrows. Kyla moved closer. Baron Kirov was sweating, wiping his palms on his tunic, speaking nervously to the Caladoran nobles he stood with. He settled in for a decent view of Baron Kirov. The God King had worked his way through half of the squads, and Sakage bookies were already taking bets on which number out of each group of 13 would die. The Caladoran soldiers noticed. Kyla wondered how many Cenarians would die for the bookies' callousness when the Caladoran soldiers went roaming the city tonight, in grief for their dead and fury at how the Sakage fouled everything it touched.
I've got to get out of this damned city.
The next squad had made it through 10 men without one drawing the short straw. It was almost worth paying attention as the men got more and more desperate as each of their neighbors was spared and their own chances became grimmer. The 11th man, 40-ish and all sinew and gristle, pulled the short straw. He chewed on the end of his mustache as he handed the straw back to the God King, but otherwise didn't betray any emotion. Neff glanced to where Duchess Jadwin and her husband were seated on the platform.
I examined the throne room, and I felt something I've never encountered before. The entire castle smells of the magic that killed so many of our Meisters, but some spots in the throne room simply don't. It's like there was a fire in the house, but you walk into one room and it doesn't smell like smoke.
That doesn't match what we know of the Silver Kakari.
No, Your Holiness. I think there's a 7th Kakari, a secret Kakari. I think it negates magic. And I think this Night Angel has it.
Gareth thought about that as the ranks reformed, leaving a corpse before them. The man's face had been utterly destroyed. It was impressive work. The squad had either worked hard to prove their commitment, or they hadn't liked the poor bastard. Gareth nodded, pleased. He extended the veer claw again and crushed the corpse's head.
Your sacrifice is accepted. Thus, you are cleansed.
Two of his bodyguards moved the corpse to the side of the platform. They were stacked there in their gore, so that even though the Cenarians couldn't see each man's death, they would see the aftermath.
A Kakari hidden for 700 years? What mastery does it bestow, hiding? What does that do for me?
Oh, Your Holiness, with such a Kakari, you or your agent could walk into the heart of the Chantry and take every treasure they have. Unseen. It's possible your agent could enter Ezra's Wood itself and take 7 centuries worth of artifacts for you. There would then be no more need for armies or subtlety. At one stroke, you could take all Mithkiru by the throat.
No doubt Neff would bravely volunteer to undertake the perilous task. Still, the mere thought of such Kakari occupied Gareth through the deaths of another teenager, 2 men in their prime, and a seasoned campaigner wearing one of the highest awards for merit that the God King bestowed.
Look into it.
Gareth wondered if Kali knew of this 7th Kakari. He wondered if Dorian knew of it. Dorian, his first acknowledged son. Dorian, who would have been his heir. Dorian, the prophet. Dorian, the betrayer. Dorian had been here. Gareth was sure of it. Only Dorian could have brought Kurok, Jorsen Alkesti's mighty sword. Some mages had appeared with it for a single moment and obliterated 50 Meisters and 3 Wurdmeisters, then disappeared. Neff was obviously waiting for Gareth to ask about it, but Gareth had given up on finding Kurok. Dorian was no fool. He wouldn't have brought Kurok so close if he thought he might lose it. How do you outmaneuver a man who can see the future? The God King squinted as he crushed another head. Every time he did that, he got blood on his own snow-white clothing. It was deliberate, but irritating all the same, and there was nothing dignified about having blood squirt in your eye.
Your sacrifice is accepted. Thus, you are cleansed.
Gareth stood on the front of the platform as the squad took its place back on the parade ground. For the entire review, he hadn't turned to face the Cenarians who were sitting on the platform behind him. Now he did. The beard flared to life as he turned. Black tendrils crawled up his face, swarmed over his arms, through his legs, and even out from his pupils. He allowed them a moment to suck in light, so that the God King appeared to be an unnatural splotch of darkness in the rising morning light. Then he put an end to that. He wanted the nobles to see him. There wasn't an eye that wasn't huge. It wasn't solely the Vir or Gareth's inherent majesty that stunned them. It was the corpses stacked like cordwood to each side and behind him, framing him like a picture. It was the blood and brain-spattered white clothing he wore. He was awesome in his power and terrible in his majesty. Perhaps, if she survived, he'd have Duchess Trudana Jodwin paint the scene. The God King regarded the nobles, and the nobles on the platform regarded the God King. He wondered if any of them had yet counted their own number. 13. He extended his handful of straw toward his nobles.
Come! Kali will cleanse you!
This time, he had no intention of letting fate decide who would die. Commander Gare looked at the God King. Gare's face drained of color. He drew a long straw. It was several moments before it occurred to him not to appear too relieved. Most of the rest were lesser nobles, the men and women who'd made the late King Alain Gunder IX's government work. They had all been so easily subverted. Extortion could be so simple. But it gained Gareth nothing to kill these peons, even if they had failed him. That brought him to a sweating Trudana Jodwin. She was the 12th in line, and her husband was last. Gareth paused. He let them look at each other. They knew. Everyone who was watching knew that one or the other of them would die, and it all depended on Trudana's draw.
Out of all the nobles here, Duke Jodwin, you are the only one who was never in my employ. So obviously you didn't fail me. Your wife, on the other hand, did.
What?
Didn't you know she was cheating on you with the prince? She murdered him on my orders.
There was something beautiful about standing in the middle of what should be an intensely private moment. The Duke's fear-paled face went gray. He had clearly been even less perceptive than most cuckolds. Intriguingly, Trudana Jodwin looked stricken. Her expression wasn't the self-righteousness Gareth expected. He thought she'd point the finger, tell her husband why it was his fault. Instead, her eyes spoke pure culpability. Gareth could only guess that the Duke had been a decent husband, and she knew it. She had cheated because she had wanted to. And now, 2 decades of lies were collapsing.
Trudana, you have served well. But you could have served better. So here is your reward and your punishment.
The God King extended the straws toward her.
The short straw is on your left.
She looked into Gareth's veer-darkened eyes and at the straws, and then into her husband's eyes. It was an immortal moment. Gareth knew that the plaintive look in the Duke's eyes would haunt Trudana Jodwin for as long as she lived. The God King had no doubt what she would choose, but obviously Trudana thought herself capable of self-sacrifice. Steeling herself, she reached for the short straw then stopped. She looked at her husband, looked away, and pulled the long straw for herself. It was lovely. The sound pierced every Cenarian heart in the courtyard. It seemed pitched perfectly to carry the God King's message. This could be you. As the nobles, including Trudana, surrounded the Duke with death in their hearts, every one of them feeling damned for their participation, but participating all the same, the Duke turned to his wife.
No! I love you, Trudana! I have always loved you! I have... Ah! Ah! Oh, God!
The God King could only smile. As Trudana Jadwin hesitated over her choice, Kyler thought that if he had taken Mama Kay's job, now would be the perfect moment to strike. Every eye was on the platform. Kyler had turned toward Baron Kirov, studying what shock and horror looked like on his face, when he noticed that only 5 guards stood on the wall beyond the Baron. He recounted quickly. 6. But one of them held a bow and a handful of arrows in his bow hand. Kyler caught a glimpse of the back section of the temporary platform splitting off and falling. Something flashing, scintillating colors flew up into the air. As everyone else turned toward it, Kyler turned away. The sparkle bomb exploded with a small concussion and an enormous flash of white light. Kyler saw the 6th soldier on the wall draw an arrow. It was Jonas Severin, a wet boy with 50 kills to his name. A gold-tipped arrow streaked toward the God King. The God King's hands were clasped over his eyes, but shields like bubbles were already blooming around him. The arrow hit the outermost shield and burst into flame as the shield popped. Another arrow was already on the way, and it passed through the fraying outer shield and hit one closer in. The next popped, and the next, as Jonas Severing shot with amazing speed. He was using his talent to hold his spare arrows in midair so that as soon as he released a shot, the next arrow was already coming to his fingertips. The shields were breaking faster than the God King could reform them. The wet boy, who'd been hiding beneath the platform, jumped onto the platform on the God King's blind side. He hesitated as one last wavering shield bloomed inches from the God King's skin, and Kyla saw that he wasn't a wet boy at all. It was a child of perhaps 14, Jonas Severing's apprentice. The boy was so focused on the God King, he didn't keep low, didn't keep moving. Kyla saw the boy go down with an arrow in his chest, even as the God King's last shield popped. People were charging toward the gates, trampling their neighbors. Several of the Meisters, still blinded and panicked, were flinging green missiles indiscriminately into the crowd and the soldiers around them. Kyler turned to find who killed the wet boy's apprentice. Not 10 paces away stood Hugh Gibbet,
the butcher who had slaughtered Logan Geyer's entire family.
The best wet boy in the city now that Durzo Blint was dead. Jonas Severing was already fleeing, not sparing a moment of anguish for his dead apprentice. Hugh released a second arrow, and Kyler saw it streak into Jonas Severing's back. The wet boy pitched forward off the wall and out of view, but Kyler had no doubt he was dead. Hugh Gibbet had betrayed the Sakage, and now he'd saved the God King. The Kakari was in Kyler's hand before he was even aware of it.
What? I wouldn't kill the architect of Cenaria's destruction, but now I'm going to kill a bodyguard?
Of course, calling Hugh Gibbet a bodyguard was like calling a bear a furry animal. But the point remained. Kyla pulled the Kakari back into his skin. Ducking, so Hugh wouldn't see his face, Kyla joined the streams of panicked Cenarians flooding out the castle gate. The Jadwin estate had survived the fires that had reduced so much of the city to rubble. Kyla came to the heavily guarded front gate, and the guards opened the sally port for him wordlessly. Kyler made his way to the hut behind the manse where the Cromwells lived.
Aline had been the last orphan the Cromwells took in, and all her siblings had moved on to other trades or to serve other houses. Only her foster mother still served the Jodwins. Since the coup, Kyler, Aline, and Yuli had stayed here. With Kyler's safe houses burned or inaccessible, it was the only choice. Kyler was thought to be dead, so he didn't want to stay in any of the Sakage safe houses where he might be recognized. In any case, every safe house was full to breaking. No one wanted to be out on the streets with the roving bands of Kaladorans. No one was in the hut, so Kyler went to the manse's kitchen. 11-year-old Yuli was standing on a stool, leaning over a tub of soapy water, scrubbing pans. Kyler swept in and picked her up onto one arm, spun her around.
You've been keeping Aline out of trouble, like I told you?
I've been trying, but I think this one's hopeless.
Yuli had been raised by servants in Sonaria Castle, believing for her own protection that she was an orphan. The truth was that she was the daughter of Mama Kay and Durzo Blint. Durzo had only found out about her in the last days of his life, and Kyler had promised him that he would look after the girl. After the initial awkwardness of explaining that he wasn't her father, things had gone better than Kyler could have expected.
Hopeless? I'll show you hopeless.
Aline carried a huge cauldron with the grime of yesterday's stew baked onto the sides and set it down next to Yuli's stack of dishes. Kyler marveled at how she'd changed in a mere week. Or perhaps the change was in how he saw her. Aline still had the thick scars Rat had given her as a child. An X across her full lips, one on her cheek, and a crescent looping from her eyebrow to the corner of her mouth. But Kyler barely noticed them. Now he saw radiant skin, eyes bright with intelligence and happiness, her grin lopsided, not because of a scar, but from planned mischief. And how a woman could look so good in modest servants' woolens and an apron was one of the great mysteries of the universe. Aline grabbed an apron from a hook and looked at Kyler with a predatory gleam in her eye.
Oh no, not me.
She looped the apron over his head and pulled him close, slowly and seductively. She was staring at his lips, and he couldn't help but stare at hers as she wet them with her tongue.
I think that...
Aline pulled him against her, her hands on the small of his back, her mouth tilting up, her sweet scent filling his nostrils.
That's much better.
She yanked the apron knot tight behind his back and released him abruptly, stepping back out of range.
Now you can help me. Do you want to cut the potatoes or the onions?
Kyler leapt forward and Aline tried to dodge, but he used his talent to grab her. He'd been practicing in the last week, and though so far he could only extend his reach a pace or so behind his own arms, this time it was enough. He pulled Aline in and kissed her. Kyler reached out and swatted the dishwater toward the source of his irritation. Aline disentangled herself and covered her mouth, trying not to laugh. Kyler had managed to drench Yuli's face completely. She raised her hand and swatted water back at him, and he let it hit him.
All right, Squirt. I deserve that. Truce now. Where are those potatoes?
They settled smoothly into the easy routine of kitchen work. Aline asked him what he'd seen and learned, and though he checked constantly for eavesdroppers, he told her everything about studying the Baron and helplessly watching the assassination attempt. Such sharing was, perhaps, the most boring thing a couple could do. But Kyler had been denied the boring luxuries of everyday life for his whole life. To share, simply to speak the truth to a person who cared, was unfathomably precious. A wet boy, Durzo had taught Kyler, must be able to walk away from everything at a moment's notice. A wet boy is always alone. So this moment, this simple communion, was why Kyler was finished with the Way of Shadows. He'd spent more than half his life training tirelessly to become the perfect killer. He didn't want to kill anymore.
They needed a third man for the job, to be a lookout and backup knife man. We could have done it. Their timing was so good. 1 second different, and they would have pulled it off with only the two of them. If I'd been there, Hugh Gibbet and the God King both would be dead. We'd have 50,000 Gunders. Gunders. Guess they won't be calling them that anymore, now that all the Gunders are dead.
You want to know if you did the right thing?
Yes.
Kyler, There are always going to be people so bad that we think they deserve to die. In the castle, when Roth was hurting you, I was this close to trying to kill him myself. If it had only been a little longer, I don't know. What I do know is what you've told me about what killing has done to your soul. No matter what good it seems to do for the world, it destroys you. I can't watch that, Kyla. I won't. I care about you too much. I really do.
All right. Then there's a job I need to do tonight. We should be able to leave in the morning.
Hell's Asshole was no place for a king. Appropriately, the hole was the lowest extremity of the jail Cenarians called the Maw. The entrance to the Maw was a demonic visage carved from jagged black fireglass. Prisoners were marched straight into its open mouth, down a ramp often made slick by fear-loosened bladders. In the hole itself, the stone carver's art had been eschewed for the sheer visceral fears evoked by tight spaces, the dark, heights, the eerie howling of the wind rising from the depths, and the knowledge that every prisoner with whom you shared the hole had been deemed unworthy of a clean death. The hole was unrelentingly hot and reeked of brimstone and human waste in its three forms: their shit, their dead, and their unwashed flesh. There was only a single torch far overhead on the other side of the grate that separated the human animals from the rest of the prisoners in the Maw. 11 men and one woman shared the hole with Logan Geyer. They hated him for his knife, and for his powerful body, and for his cultured accent. Somehow, even in this nightmare menagerie of freaks and twists, he was different, isolated. Logan sat with his back to the wall. There was only one wall because the hole was a circle. In the middle was a hole 5 paces wide that opened into a chasm. The chasm's sides were perfectly vertical, perfectly sheer fireglass. There was no guessing how deep it was. When the prisoners kicked their waist into the hole, they heard no sound. The only thing that escaped the hole was the deep stench of a sulfuric hell and the intermittent wailing made by the wind, or the ghosts, or the tortured souls of the dead, or whatever it was that made that sanity-breaking sound. At first, Logan had wondered why his fellows would defecate against the wall and only later, if ever, kick the feces down the hall. The first time he had to go, he knew. You'd have to be insane to squat near the hole. You couldn't do anything down here that made you vulnerable. When one inmate had to move past another, he shuffled quickly and suspiciously. Pushing another inmate into the hole was the easiest way to kill. What made it worse was that the shelf of rock that circled the hole was only 3 paces wide, and the ground slanted down toward the hole. That shelf was all the world to the holers. It was the thin, slippery slope to death. Logan hadn't slept in the 7 days since the coup. He blinked his eyes. 7 days. He was starting to get weak. Even Finn, who got most of the last meat, hadn't eaten in 4 days.
You're bad luck, 13. That ain't even fed us since you got here.
Finn was the only one who called him 13. The rest had accepted the name he'd given himself in a moment of madness.
You mean since you ate the last guard? You think that might have something to do with it?
Finn said nothing, just kept chewing and stretching the rope in his hands. The man already wore an entire coil of rope that was so thick it almost obscured a frame as sinewy as the ropes themselves. Finn was the most feared of the inmates. Logan wouldn't call him the leader because that would have implied that the inmates had a social order. The men were like beasts, shaggy, their skin so dirty he couldn't guess what color they had been before their imprisonment. Eyes wild, ears alert to the slightest sound. Everyone slept light. They'd eaten 2 men the day he'd arrived.
Arrived? I jumped in. Could have had a nice clean death. Now I'm here forever, or at least until they eat me. Oh, gods, they'll eat me!
Logan was distracted from his rising horror and despair by motion on the other side of the hole. It was Lily. She alone didn't cling to the wall. She was heedless of the hole, fearless. She sat down next to Logan. She was a plain woman, her age indeterminate. She could have been 50,
but Logan guessed she was closer to 20. She still had most of her teeth.
What are you gonna do?
I'm going to get out, and I'm going to take back my country.
You hold on to that kingship. Make them think you're crazy. I see you looking around like a little boy lost. You're living with animals. You want to keep living, you be a monster. You want to hold on to something, you bury it deep. Then you do what you gotta.
The madness was taking him. Dorian stayed in the saddle only from instinct. The external world seemed distant, unimportant, buried under mist while the visions were near, vital, vibrant. The game was on and the pieces were moving, and Dorian's vision was expanding as it never had before. The Night Angel would flee to Kaer Navan, and his powers were growing, but he wasn't using them.
What are you doing, boy?
Dorian grabbed onto that life and followed it backward. He'd spoken with Kylo once and had prophesied his death. Now he knew why he hadn't also foreseen that this Night Angel would die and wouldn't die. Durzo had confused him. Dorian had seen Durzo's life intersecting with other lives. He had seen, but he hadn't understood. He was tempted to try to follow Durzo's lives back to the first life, when Durzo had received the Kakari that Kylo now bore. He was tempted to see if he could find Ezra the Mad's life. Surely such a life would burn so brilliantly he couldn't miss it. Maybe there he could follow Ezra, learn what Ezra knew, learn how he had learned it. Ezra had made the Kakari 7 centuries ago, and the Kakari had made Kyler immortal. It was only 3 steps to one of the most respected and reviled magi of history. 3 steps. To find someone so famous who had been dead so long, it was tempting. But it would take time. Maybe months. But oh!
The things I could learn about the past, while the present falls apart. Focus, Dorian.
Focus!
Clamoring back onto Kyla's life, Dorian followed it from his youth in the Warrens, his friendship with Aline and Jarl, Jarl's rape, Aline's maiming, Kyla's first kill at 11, Durzo's apprenticeship, Mama Kay's instruction, Count Drake's softening influence, Kyla's friendship with Logan, meeting again with Aline, stealing the Kakari, the coup at the castle, killing his master, and finding Roth Ursul.
My little brother, and as much of a monster as I once was. Focus, Dorian.
There. He watched as Kylo poisoned Mama Kay for justice and gave her the antidote for mercy. He could know what choices a man made, but without knowing why, Dorian wouldn't be able to guess which way Kylo would turn in the future. Kylo had already taken less obvious routes, impossible routes. Given the choice of taking his lover's life or his mentor's, he'd chosen to give his own. The bull had offered each of its horns, and Kyler had vaulted over the bull's head. That was the Kyler that mattered. In that moment, Dorian saw Kyler's naked soul.
Now I have you, Kyler. Now I know you.
There was a sudden pain in Dorian's arm, but now that he had a firm grip on Kyler, he wasn't letting go. Kyler ached to synthesize the cruel realities of the street with the pious impulses Count Drake had somehow infected him with. Infected? The word came from Kyler. So, like Durzo, he sometimes saw mercy as weakness.
You are going to be damnably difficult, aren't you?
Dorian watched as Kyler dealt with Kaer Navan's incompetent Sakaga, as Kyler picked herbs, as he paid taxes, as he fought with Aline, as he tried to be a normal human being, but he wasn't doing well. The pressure was building. Kyler took out his wet boy grays, went out on the roofs.
Funny. He does that regardless of the choices he makes up to this point.
And then, one night, there was a knock on the door and Jarl showed up to stretch Kyler on another crux between the woman he loves and the life he hates and the friend he loves and the life he ought to hate and one duty and another duty and honor and betrayal. Kyler is now Shadow in Twilight. A growing colossus with one foot planted in the day and another in the night. But a shadow is an ephemeral beast, and twilight must either darken into night or lighten into day. Kyler then opens the door for Jarl. Futures crashing.
Damn it, Dorian!
Fear is slapping him. Dorian was suddenly aware that Fear must be about to do it several times because his jaw had throbbed on both sides. Something will be seriously wrong with his left arm. He looks. Confusion's crashing in his head, trying to find the right speed of time. There was an arrow sticking out of his arm. A black-baited Caladoran Highlander's arrow. Poisoned. Fear slapped him again.
Stop! Stop!
Dorian waved his hands around. It made his left arm blossom into pain.
What's happened?
Raiders.
Bunch of idiots trying to take something home to brag about.
Something, of course, would have been Solon's, Fear's, and Dorian's ears. One of the four corpses already wore two ears dangling from a necklace. They looked fresh.
They're all dead?
Solon nodded unhappily, and Dorian read the story of the brief battle around their camp. The attack had come as Fear and Dorian were setting up camp. The sun was dipping into a notch in the Faultier Mountains, and the raiding party had come from the mountain, thinking the sun would blind them. Two archers tried to cover their friend's approach, but the shot was steeply downhill, and the first arrows had missed. After that, the outcome had been a foregone conclusion. Solon was no mean hand with a sword, and Fear, mountainous, monstrously strong, and quick, Fear was a second echelon blade master. Solon had let Fear handle the swordsman. He'd been too late to save Dorian taking an arrow, but he had killed both archers with magic. The whole thing had probably taken less than 2 minutes.
The pity is they're from the Churoc clan. They'd have happily killed the Hraggle clan bastards guarding the Caladoran baggage train we're following.
I thought Screaming Winds was impregnable. How'd the raiders get on this side of the border?
Solon shook his head. It drew Dorian's attention to his hair, which was a flat black except at the roots. Since Solon had killed 50 Meisters by using Kurok, and nearly killed himself from the sheer amount of magic he'd used to do it, his hair was growing in white. Not old man salt and pepper white, but a snow white that struck a sharp contrast against a face that showed a man in his prime, handsome, with olive sethy skin and features chiseled from a military life. Solon had complained at first that his vision was either all in wild colors or black and white from using Kurok, but that seemed to have cleared.
Impregnable, yes. Impassable for an army, yes. But this late in the summer, these young men can climb the mountains. Lots of them die on the climb, or storms come up out of nowhere and wash them off the rock. But if they're lucky and strong, nothing stops them. You ready with that arrow yet, Dorian?
Though all three men were magi, there was no question of helping him. Not with this. Dorian was a Hoth Salar, a brother of healing. His hopes to cure his own growing madness had driven him to the healer's highest ranks. Water suddenly soaked Dorian's arm around the arrowhead.
Oh, what was that?
All the moisture from the blood that's already poisoned. It should all stick to the arrow when you pull it out.
Me?
You're ridiculous.
Solon reached over and ripped out the arrow. He stared at the arrow. The barbs had been bent down flat so they wouldn't tear flesh on their way out, but the shaft was covered in a black shell of blood, and the poison coaxed into a crystalline structure. It had swelled the shaft to 3 times its original width. Flows of magic began dancing in the air around Dorian like tiny fireflies, like 100 spiders spinning glowing webs, tapestries of light. This was the part that impressed the other men. Theoretically, any magus could heal himself, but for some reason it not only tended not to work well, but was also intensely painful to heal more than the smallest wound. It was as if the patient had to feel every pain and discomfort and irritation and itching that a wound would have inflicted in the entire time it was healing. When a magus healed someone else, he could numb the patient. When he healed himself, numbing anything could lead to mistakes and death. Female mages, magi, on the other hand, had no such problems. They routinely healed themselves.
You're incredible. How do you do that?
It's just focus. I've had lots of practice.
Dorian smiled and shook himself as if casting off his weariness, and suddenly his face was animated, and he was totally present with them in a way that was becoming rare. Solon looked bereaved. Dorian's madness was irreversible. It would grow until he was a babbling idiot who slept outside or in barns. He would come to be totally disregarded and have only one or two moments of lucidity each year. Sometimes, those moments would come when no one was around for him to tell what he had learned.
Stop it, Solon. I've just had a revelation. We're going the wrong way. At least you are, Fear. You need to follow Kurak south to Kura.
What do you mean? I thought we were following the sword. Anyway, my place is with you.
Solon, you and I have to go north to Screaming Winds.
Wait!
But Dorian's eyes had glazed again. He was gone.
Lovely. Just lovely. I swear he does that on purpose.
It was past midnight when Jarl joined them in the Cromwell's little hut. He was more than an hour late. Aline's foster mother was asleep in the bedroom they all shared, so Kyler and Aline and Yuli were all sitting in the front room.
Sorry. The Paleys are punishing the Warrens for the assassination attempt. I wanted to get back to check on some things, but they've sealed the bridges. No bribes enough today.
Kyler could tell Jarl was avoiding details because Yuli was in the room, but considering how bad things were in the Warrens before the assassination attempt, Kyler could barely imagine how they must be tonight.
Does this mean the job's cancelled?
Oh, it's on.
Jarl handed a purse to Aline. It looked suspiciously light.
I took the liberty of bribing the gate guards in advance. The price has already gone up, and I guarantee tomorrow it will go up again. You have the list of times when the guards we bribed are working this week?
Jarl opened a pack and took out a cream-colored tunic, trousers, and high black boots.
Memorized.
Look, I know Kyler's used to doing jobs where he doesn't know why he's doing what he's doing, but I need to understand this. Why is someone paying 500 gunders for Kyler to pretend to die? That's a fortune.
Not to a Calidorian duke. Here's the best I've been able to put it together. The dukes in Calidor aren't the same as our dukes, because the nobility in Calidor is always inferior to the Meisters. But the Meisters still need people to manage the peasants and so forth, so Duke Vargon is rich, but he's had to fight for every scrap of power he has. He came to Cenaria hoping to advance himself, but the position he thought he would get, leading Cenaria's royal guard, was given to Lieutenant Horan Gare, now Commander Gare.
To pay him off for leading Cenaria's nobles into an ambush during the coup. The traitor.
Exactly. Commander Gare goes to the docks one morning a week with a few of his most trusted men to pick up Sakagi bribe money and pretend to be patrolling. This morning, he's going to see his rival, Duke Vargon, commit the murder of a minor Cenaria noble, Baron Kirov. Commander Gare will happily arrest the Duke. In a few days or weeks, the dead Baron Kirov will show up. Commander Gare will be disgraced for arresting a duke for no reason, and most likely Duke Vargon will take his job. A number of things could go wrong, which is why Kyler's only getting 500 gunders.
It sounds awfully complicated.
Trust me, when it comes to Calidorian politics, this is simple.
How's the Sakage going to turn this to their advantage?
We try to get hold of Baron Kirov, but apparently the duke isn't too stupid. Kirov's already gone.
The Sakage would have kidnapped Baron Kirov? Why?
If the Sakage grabbed Kirov, they could blackmail Commander Gare. Commander Gare would know the moment Kirov showed up, he'd be doomed. So the Sakage would have owned him.
You know, sometimes I try to imagine what this city would be like without the Sakage, and I can't. I want to get out of here, Kyler. Can I come with you tonight?
There's not enough space for an adult. Anyway, they'll be back by dawn. Yuli? Kyler? You ready?
2 hours later, they were at the docks ready to split up. Yuli would hide beneath the dock in a raft camouflaged to look like a clump of driftwood. When Kyler fell in the water, she would extend a pole for him to grab so that he could surface out of sight. There would barely be room enough in the little raft for Yuli to crouch and Kyler's head to emerge. After he emerged, the driftwood would eventually drift downstream a few hundred paces to another dock where they would emerge.
But what if it all goes wrong? I mean, really wrong?
Then tell Aline I'm sorry.
Kyler, I'm scared.
Yuli, I wanted to tell you. I mean, I wish... I wish you wouldn't call me by my real name when we're on a job.
Kyler patted her head. She hated that.
How do I look?
Just like Baron Kiroth. If I squint real hard.
Have I ever told you you're a pain in the ass?
Yuli just grinned. In a few hours, the docks would be swarming with longshoremen and sailors preparing their cargoes for the rising sun. For the moment, though, it was quiet. The docks' private night watch had been paid off, but the bigger fear was of the groups of Caladoran soldiers who might wander by, looking for blood. Mercifully, it seemed most of them were in the Warrens tonight.
Well then, see you on the other side.
Yuli's eyes filled with tears.
Go on, I'll be fine.
Yuli went, and when she was safely out of sight, his face began shimmering. Kyla's lean young face put on a second chin. A red beard sprouted in the Caladoran fashion. His nose grew crooked, and his eyebrows became great wide brushes. Now, he was Baron Kiroth. He pulled out a hand mirror and checked himself. He scowled. The illusory nose shrank a little. He opened his mouth, smiled, scowled, and winked, seeing how the face moved. It wasn't good, but it would have to do. Yuli would have helped him get the face right, but the less she knew about his little talents, the better. He started down the dock.
Dear gods.
Duke Tentavargan approached.
Is that you?
The Duke was sweaty and pasty pale, even in the light of the torches on the end of the dock.
Duke Vargan, I got your message.
Kyler extended his hand and clasped the Duke's wrist.
You'll be fine. Just do everything like we planned.
Baron Kiroth, thank you.
So you're the player?
Yes. Let's try not to put me out of work.
I've never killed anyone before.
Let's make sure tonight isn't your first.
Kyler looked at the jeweled dagger tucked into the Duke's belt. It was an heirloom in the Duke's family, and its inexplicable loss would be part of the evidence that the Duke really had killed Baron Kiroth.
If you do this, you'll be going to prison, and not a nice one. We can call it off.
No, no. Have you ever done this before?
Set up someone by pretending to be someone else? Sure. Pretended to get killed? Not so much.
Don't worry, they're here.
Kyler jerked away from the Duke as if startled.
Oh, is that a threat?
The Duke grabbed his arm.
You'll do as I tell you! Or what? The God King will hear about this.
They definitely had the guard's attention now.
You'll say nothing! You aren't smart enough to take the throne, Duke Vargan. You're a coward, and...
One stab. The blood bladder is right over my heart. I'll do everything else.
Kyla contorted Baron Kiroth's face into a sneer and turned away. The Duke grabbed Kyla's arm and yanked him back. With a savage motion, Vargan rammed the dagger not into the sheep's bladder of blood, but into Kyla's stomach. Staggering backward, Kyla looked down. His cream-colored silk tunic was dripping red-black blood. Tensa's hands were gory, and flecks of red dotted the blue of his cloak.
Whoa! What are you doing?
He swayed, grabbing at the end of the railing to hold himself up. Sweating profusely, his black hair hanging in lank ropes, Tensa ignored him. Every trace of the hesitant, bumbling noble he'd been only a minute before had disappeared. He grabbed a fistful of Kyler's hair. Duke Vargan let Kyler drop to his knees. Through eyes dimmed with pain, Kyla saw Commander Gare charging down the dock with his sword drawn and two guards at his heels. Duke Vargan dragged the dagger across Kyla's throat. Then, Duke Vargan jammed his dagger into Kyla's shoulder.
Stop! Stop now or die!
Duke Vargan propped the calfskin boot on Kyla's shoulder and smiled. With a shove, he propelled Kyler off the dock and into the river. The water was so cold, Kyler went numb. Well, maybe that was from the blood loss. In moments, air bubbled out of his mouth and, disconcertingly, his throat. Then there was agony as he breathed the thick, dirty water of the plith. He thrashed weakly, but only for a moment. Then the calm descended. His aching body was only a distant pulse. Something jabbed his body, and he tried to grab for it instinctively. He was supposed to grab. There was something he was supposed to remember about a catchpole. But if his hand even moved, he couldn't tell. The world didn't go black, didn't fade into darkness. His vision went white, his brain starving as blood poured from his neck. Something jabbed him again. He wished it would go away. The water was warm, a perfect, peaceful